Did I see Max Dresden on your list anywhere?
He's there.
And how about Heller over in computers?
I've tried to reach him. I'll get him. Yeah. All right. Let's go through these questions quickly.
All right.
But I want to ask you some other questions than those here.
Sure. So I'll follow your lead.
All right. Well, let's start out. Your name and department, rank and position now or when you first joined the university.
All right. My name is Lee Koppelman. At the present time, I'm a leading professor, Department of Political Science. I also recently started the Center for Regional Policy Studies, and I'm the director of the center. I came to the campus a little more than 20 years ago, in 1967, in an adjunct situation. I was invited at that time to join by several members of the political science department, particularly Merton Reichler and the late Ashley Schiff. And I've been affiliated for 21 years now directly with the campus. Full-time at the present.
Yes. What was your position at the time that you became adjunct? Where were you?
I was the executive director of the Long Island Regional Planning Board and the director of the Suffolk County Planning Commission, titles that I've held right up until the present, until I've come to the campus on a full-time basis.
I see. All right. Who was, you've indicated three and four.
Well, Dean Ross was the one who was chairman of the political science department at the time.
Oh, he was chairman of history.
History, rather. Right. And he was part of the review committee. But I gathered it was fairly informal in those days because it wasn't too rigorous an interview. Everyone said, "We're happy to have you," and that was the end of that.
Yes. How far back do you go in your knowledge of Stony Brook?
Well, our activities in government really go back to the creation of the campus here at Stony Brook. H. Lee Dennison was the county executive at the time, and the original intent by the state seemed to be the creation of an engineering center at the Coe Estate, which was a temporary setup. H. Lee Dennison wanted a major comprehensive university in Suffolk County because Suffolk, in many senses, was considered an educational wasteland. And there was a strong feeling that Stony Brook offered an opportunity to provide precisely that kind of a center. And since the County of Suffolk created the Suffolk County Community College in 1960, there was a question of what happens to the two-year students at the conclusion of 2 years, and those of us in government perceive Stony Brook as the logical answer to that particular issue. So we started to become heavily involved with the future of Stony Brook in 1962.
I see. Did you have any relations with Ward Melville or with the central office in Albany?
We had relations with Governor Rockefeller on a very personal and very close relationship, and similarly with Ward Melville. We had set up a Department of Commerce, a Department of Commerce and Industry, and we asked Ward Melville to be the first chairman. And I had a very close working relationship with Ward from then until he died, because we shared a lot of mutual interests, including participation by his personal friend, the late curator of ornithology, Dr. Robert Cushman Murphy. And we worked on a number of conservation projects together, and out of that, we also worked on a number of issues concerning the university, including Ward's decision to donate 1,100 acres for the establishment of the Stony Brook campus.
480.
480, yeah. At that time, Ward Melville did discuss it with Dennison, and I was at the meeting. And he had indicated his vision for an extension of his concept of Stony Brook as a livable Williamsburg. And after the discussion, I recall talking to Dennison, and H. Lee said, Ward's going to be in for a surprise, because if he thinks we're going to support a rinky-dink ye olde community college, he's sadly mistaken. But
Lee was an engineer.
He was an engineer. He saw great things for Stony Brook. He envisioned 50,000 students, and Stony Brook was going to be the center of the universe. That certainly wasn't Ward Melville's idea of what was going to be established here. But yes, we had a close working rapport. And I'd say this, afterwards, when it was clear that Stony Brook was to be more than a very nice public equivalent of Mount Holyoke or some other genteel school, Ward did convey his concern to Governor Rockefeller, but he did it as a gentleman. He never made any overt attacks against Stony Brook, even though he certainly had some private comments about the direction the campus was taking.
Right, particularly the architecture.
Well, I think we all joined in on that New York telephone modern that Rockefeller imposed was not exactly the most architectural advantage for this campus.
Was it Rockefeller? I thought really that got started under Harriman, and that Rockefeller set up the construction fund to get control of the architects.
Well, the answer to that is yes, but some of the architects that Rockefeller selected were no real improvement over the ones that Mr. Harriman started. The Harriman contribution was fairly limited to a couple of the original red brick buildings, but some of the additional buildings that Rockefeller contributed to perhaps achieved as much controversy as the original buildings. And certainly the most controversial was the health center when he brought in Goldberg from Chicago, who designed those round residential towers at the Chicago River. That was a successful design for a residential condominium. I'm not sure it was equally successful for a major medical center.
All right. I've interviewed Ken Laval, and I also had to apologize over and over again for the quality of the dormitories, the way they were kept. Did you have any reactions from people about the dormitories?
The issue of the dormitories was somewhat mixed, because the university had a multifaceted approach to the dormitories. Right at the beginning, there was some concern with how the dormitories would be set up vis-a-vis the outside community. There certainly was a need for on-campus housing, because the neighboring Stony Brook community was not receptive to the campus, and that's putting it mildly. Internally, as far as the dormitories are concerned, I thought the administration did a rather brilliant thing when they named each one of the dormitories after a noted New York person, and they set up the college program with a faculty member serving as a college master. I don't know if it was a model on the Cambridge-Oxford situation, but I thought it was a successful concept. But unfortunately, like many good concepts, the execution sometimes leaves a bit to be desired. If you had a faculty member like the late Dr. Ashley Schiff, who took the job responsibly, and the residential college became a true center of activity, as his did, it was eminently successful, and the maintenance of the building showed, because there was a pride in the facility and so on. Unfortunately, some of the other college masters did not take the job as seriously, and the dormitory was pretty much left to student control, and the maintenance and the quality of life was not as good. So it was a mixed bag from a very, very successful situation to once bordering on horror stories. But I think it also has to be understood that Rockefeller's contribution in creating the state construction program that was then administered by the late Dr. Al Danafi was not, in my vision, the best way to go, because the real control was in Albany, not at the Stony Brook campus. And I believe a lot was lost in what I considered very poor administration on the part of the state office. It not only created conflict, but I think it created poor construction in many cases. And this was unfortunate.
Ward Melville, I have been led to understand, had the idea of the college partly as a means of sealing off some of the land south of Stony Brook from possible development. In that he was successful. And he was really doing two things at the same time. There was a Long Island Press dinner for him. Were you at that dinner? That was in 56. And Rockefeller came down and was the speaker.
He was the keynoter.
Keynoter, yes. I wish that I could find either that speech that he made or the one he made at the opening, at the groundbreaking here in 60.
I have a newspaper blog at Halpog.
You do?
And I'll go back through and see if we have the early records, because we had...
I'd like to copy them.
If I have it, I'll make Xerox copies for you.
Okay.
But in response to your comment, which is a correct one, by the way, in my judgment, I believe it's also not a complete one, Ward Melville was a rather complex man.
Very.
And yes, he wanted to contain Stony Brook from the suburban sprawl that was beginning to take place, particularly in the 50s. Suffolk was the fastest growing county in the United States at that time. But he could have achieved that simply by making a preserve or a park or an extension of the St. George Golf Course. He did not have to donate the land for a state campus to do that. And I bring up this point because his vision was greater than merely what some people would connote to be a desire merely to protect the enclave of Stony Brook.
That's right.
He had a larger vision. Stony Brook, in effect, was a livable Williamsburg. And just as William and Mary is part and parcel of the Virginia syndrome, I think Ward Melville had a larger picture of what a true community should be. And certainly education was the central focus point of that. And therefore, his interest was not just in museums, which is another adjunct of the educational process, but the idea that Stony Brook would be total as a civilized community and having not just art and museums and waterfront protection and historic preservation and architectural renovation, but also to have a proper seat of higher learning as part of that broader image. And I think that is the major contribution that I think Ward should be credited with.
Good. I'm glad you made that statement, because I have not had anything like it from anybody else.
Well, Ward was a controversial man, and I don't think enough people worked with him on a close basis. He was very, very complex. I had worked with him on a number of open space objectives and on community beautification, even to the point where each year Ward and I would go around in his Rolls Royce and he would judge gas stations. Now, he was one of the wealthiest men on Long Island, very distinguished philanthropist, and we would spend 2 days looking at toilet bowls and gas stations to judge which gas station was doing the best job. So he was an interesting fellow, but very complex. I remember at one time he made a comment to me about my seeming standoffishness because I'd worked with him on a number of projects. And since he was of an older generation, I treated him with the respect that older generations deserve. But I also was somewhat aloof from the man. And on one occasion, he did raise the point as to why I was not only formal with him, but aloof. And very candidly, I said to him that I work with him because I share the same objectives, but I felt that the man was an anti-Semite, and therefore I would do what I had to do as a government official, but I wasn't doing it out of any desire to become a personal friend. And he was quite shocked with that statement. And he asked on what basis I would draw that conclusion. And I said, well, the Stony Brook community was restricted. And he wouldn't allow any of the property under his control, any of the homes to be sold to people who were Jews. And he said, well, that wasn't a question of prejudice. He had his vision of what the community should look like, including the fact that the houses should be white and the shutters should be black and the front doors should be of a muted color, et cetera, and so forth. And that he felt Jewish people were too independent and that they wouldn't submit to his sense of what the community should be. But he wouldn't acknowledge that that was a problem. And sometime later, when the National Seashore was created, when they had the opening, and Secretary Udall was the keynoter and the one who was opening it, we went across to Fire Island, and I was with Robert Cushman Murphy at the time. And Murphy made an interesting observation. He said, you know, Ward thinks very highly of you. And I said, really? He said, yes. He was just commenting the other day. He said, a very bright young Jew who went to the right schools. But I guess he was a Victorian, and that wasn't considered improper. But on today's standards, I guess one would view it differently. But on balance, I always had a high respect for Mr. Melville in terms of his public concerns. He was a rather reticent man. He never blew his own horn. And therefore, a lot of people didn't realize his sensitive nature. But he had a real concern for community and a very democratic spirit for community. There were some people at the time when he donated the land for a state university who raised issues with him that if he wanted to have a college in the area, it didn't have to be a public school with those kinds of students. So those issues never were made public. But I think Melville was a real benefactor for the community in every sense.
What do you think was the attitude of the community toward the coming of the university? What's your feeling about it?
There are two communities that you have to deal with.
Right.
There's the immediate Stony Brook Three Village area community, and then there is the broader Long Island, or on a smaller scale, the Suffolk community. The larger the community, the more welcome was the reaction of the community to Stony Brook. It represented an opportunity for higher learning. It represented an employment center of major proportions in a community that was beginning to grow and needed jobs, and jobs of decent caliber. And so the overall reaction of the broader Long Island community was absolutely positive. Some of the private colleges were not that large and were not that competitive, so therefore some of the competitive concern raised by the privates in later years was not extant to any degree at that time. As we got closer to the campus itself, however, the local community was more and more concerned. At the beginning of the campus, I think the general attitude in the Stony Brook community was extremely positive, because they were responding to Ward Melville's image of what was going to be placed on the campus. When that image began to change, and I think it first began to change with the presidency of John Toll, because President Toll had an image of the great master plan, quote unquote, of what the campus was to be like, and in fact, he eventually even built a wooden model of what this campus was supposed to represent, that he kept in one of his conference rooms that was large scale, large size, and large thinking. And the initial concern of the community was when the issue of where the students shall reside. And the campus responded very positively by creating a local Stony Brook Council where local civic leaders invited to participate. And I thought that was a very intelligent move, because it brought in virtually all of the voices that were beginning to raise criticism of the campus. The criticism, however, was very muted. It wasn't overt opposition. It was mixed, namely that the campus was welcome, providing it didn't have a negative impact on the community. And one of the negative impacts was they didn't want students creating rooming houses in their neighborhoods. And therefore, the emphasis was that students should be housed on campus. And a second concern was whether or not the presence of the campus would initiate developers trying to create additional business shopping in the area to serve the campus. Restaurants, candy stores, whatever would normally be present. And Ward Melville and the management group in Stony Brook didn't want that either, because they had their vision of the Stony Brook Shopping Center as being the nucleus of shopping, and they didn't want strip commercial on 25A. They certainly wanted no commercial on Nichols Road. And from a planning point of view, I think they were absolutely right. And the campus certainly didn't try to do that. So I think when their fears were finally allayed, the general reaction of the community remained generally positive. As the campus grew, the Stony Brook community changed, because now you had more and more faculty becoming part and parcel of the Stony Brook community. And therefore, the feeling of positive nature was strengthened simply because of the numbers and the import of Stony Brook faculty and personnel in the Stony Brook community. They became some of the newer leaders in school activities and civic associations and so on. And I might say some of them were more virulent in environmental protection than some of the earlier residents.
Why did you come to Stony Brook?
Well, that was an easy decision to make on my part. I've always been fond of students and fond of teaching, and it was an opportunity to associate with people that I had a very high respect for. If you spend your professional career in government and you have to deal with politicians and deal with others, there isn't the intellectual stimulation that a place like Stony Brook would afford. And so when I was invited to give a course on the politics of governmental planning, I jumped at it with arms and legs moving at the same time.
Was this the right place to put the university?
In my judgment, it was the right place at the right time, but I'd have to qualify that comment. At that time, when Stony Brook was established here as a major, one of the four major state university centers, you have to understand that Suffolk County was not only an educational wasteland, it was the fastest growing county in the United States. We were overwhelmed with the need for infrastructure. As I said, in 1960, we first created the Suffolk County Community College. Prior to 1960, we had no higher learning. There was no Southampton College out at Southampton. There was no Brooklyn Polytechnic. What we did have was the State University of New York at Farmingdale, which was a two-year Aggie school, which has then changed its mission. The campus represented not only an educational opportunity, which we in government perceived because the income levels of our citizens were not such that we felt they could afford to send their children to private colleges. So the presence of a state, not only four-year, but graduate set of opportunities, we included within our concepts of planning for Suffolk County. More to the point, we were a medical wasteland. We had very few specialties, and we had no tertiary care hospital. We had several small community hospitals. The general competence of medical delivery was somewhat limited. We had no specialized facilities like burn clinics or anything of that sort. Even though several of the church-sponsored hospitals were reasonably good, some of the proprietary hospitals were not good at all. And from a county point of view, we perceived the State University as a comprehensive center with the creation of a medical center. And when you say, was it the right place at the right time, it was absolutely the right time because it was at the key period of growth and the right place. It didn't have to be Stony Brook. It could have been Central Brookhaven. It could have been in several other locations. But yes, Suffolk County was the right location. And in terms of the majority of population being centered somewhere in the vicinity of Halpog, Stony Brook was considered, even though slightly north, nevertheless, part of the centroid of population that will still remain the centroid of population well into the next century. So with the offer of land, which Ward Melville had been talking about and actually consummated, yes, it was the right location. And in fact, the county's construction of Nickel Road was not an accident. Nickel Road was constructed by the county with the idea that the county was going to do everything possible, you know, to support the university. And it has been a matter of county policy from the Denison administration in 1960 to do everything possible to make Stony Brook the center it is. And in fact, with the battle over the medical center, the county, I think, played a very pivotal role.
You want to go into that a little bit? Because I was involved in that only in the sense that two men came into my office in 62. I'd been on the job about a month or so. Two men from the Joint Commission on Education for the Health Sciences, with Malcolm Muir and Buster Evans of the Commonwealth Fund. Their idea was that, and they'd done some statistical work previously, that the state needed two medical centers, and the first one should go to Stony Brook. But the reason for that was that they thought it was better to place a new medical center on the campus of a growing institution where the administration was still relatively fluid, relatively acceptable to another addition. They made that quite clear. What do you know about the politics that followed the announcement of the report?
Well, I can only give you one point of view because there were many players that were involved in the creation of the center. The comprehensive plan did recommend that Stony Brook be the site of a center. This had to be ratified.
First center.
The first center. Yep. This had to be ratified by the trustees. This wasn't an automatic situation. They had to say, yes, we accept the report of the commission and we designate Stony Brook as the location for the first center. As soon as the report came out, there was wide interest in the downstate area. The county executive of Westchester County at the time was Ed McCallion. And Ed McCallion was a friend of the Rockefellers, and he felt that Westchester was a more suitable site, and he made that wish known. Borough President Cariello, who was a former state assemblyman and was then the borough president of Queens County, was faced with the closing of Fort Totten, declared surplus by the federal government. And he was very active with a lot of veterans groups, the Italian War veterans and the Jewish War veterans and the American Legion and the veterans of foreign wars. And they had a number of posts in Queens. And the combination of Fort Totten closing, plus the veterans' view that such a facility should really be a veterans' hospital, or at least available for veterans' use instead of them having to go to the Bronx Veterans Center, Cariello immediately put in his oar that really the proper location for a downstate center should be in Queens County, which is still Long Island, and they could get the surplus land at Fort Totten for that facility. So we had two external sources of immediate competition, Queens and Westchester County. In Suffolk County, we had a Suffolk County Academy of Medicine, which was basically the private practitioners, whose initial reaction was, we don't care where a medical center is created as long as it's not created in Suffolk County. They were very negative, and I think they viewed the creation of a teaching hospital as unfair competition, since most of the members in practice in Suffolk at that time were not board certified to begin with, and they viewed this from a business point of view as increasing, encroaching unfair competition. The County of Suffolk, through its county executive, and he was really the government at that time, viewed the medical center as an answer to Suffolk's problem. As I stated to you, this was a medical wasteland, and one of the first studies that I had to do as planning director was to look at the infrastructure of Suffolk, and I had recommended that the county create a general care hospital.
We were exporting about 800 people to New York City every year for tertiary care.
Well, we were exporting more. The 800 was merely what we were able to record. There were many Suffolk people who didn't bother to indicate, you know, their preference of choice. You know, the people who had means, you know, they went to Rockefeller Center, they went to Sloan Kettering, they went to Mayo Clinic, they went everywhere, but, you know, any of the local hospitals. So we're really talking about thousands of cases. The ones that we were shipping out, we knew about because there was, you know, an involvement. But be that as it may, I was placed by Denison on the Hill-Burton Commission, which dispensed Hill-Burton funds for hospital creation, simply because we wanted to skew it toward the construction of a general hospital for Suffolk County. Well, in looking at it, and we're talking about $1961-62, the type of tertiary care hospital that we wanted to build would have cost in the minimum of $100 million and up. That's in 1961 dollars. As a member of the Hill-Burton Committee, I got a very quick education in political numbers. I represented Suffolk County with Dr. O'Neill from the Central Islip Psychiatric Center. Dr. O'Neill wanted some Hill-Burton funds for some general surgical medical treatment as an adjunct to the Central Islip facility.
Pilgrim? Is that the Pilgrim?
No, no, that was Central Islip.
Central Islip, yeah.
Dr. O'Neill was Central Islip. And Nassau County dominated the Hill-Burton in terms of the membership. 80% of the members were Nassau County people, and they had their own agenda, and their agenda was the Nassau County Meadowbrook Medical Center. To make a long story short, when the issue was raised, all of the Hill-Burton funds extant, plus committed for the next 15 years, was voted in favor of the Meadowbrook Center. And the argument was Nassau was a more urban county, Nassau was a larger county, and Nassau had all the votes. And they sort of threw a bone to Suffolk County. Some money went, so O'Neill was happy. Most of the money went to Nassau. And it was clear that Suffolk County was not going to get any outside funding for a comprehensive general health facility. So with that background, Suffolk County government's position was, we need such a center, and Stony Brook represented that option. And by this time, we were on very, very close terms with Governor Rockefeller. He had become a personal friend, particularly of H. Lee Dennison, and my office worked closely with him. And
Dennison was county executive. I'm just simply putting that
in
on the record.
Yes, H. Lee Dennison was county executive from January 1 of 1960 to 1972. Rockefeller made his first official visit to Long Island in 1962, and the visit was to the Humanities Building, which was one of the few and one of the first buildings built here on this campus, just adjacent to the administration building at the present time. And Governor Rockefeller came here with his entire cabinet as part of a statewide visit to learn the, quote, planning problems of the state of New York.
He'd been here, though, for the groundbreaking in 60.
The groundbreaking was a ceremonial.
Yeah.
This was a gubernatorial-initiated visit that didn't have anything directly to do with the campus, but merely to use the campus as a forum for his visiting the 10 regions of the state to understand the planning concerns. And I made the presentation on behalf of Suffolk County, and Lee Dennison said that, you know, give them hell. We want Sunrise Highway built, we want the expressway completed, et cetera, and so forth. And we had the meeting in the auditorium on the first floor of the Humanities Building, and I had maps from one end of the wall to the other. And Governor Rockefeller came in with his entire entourage, Carlino and the other people at that time. They occupied the first two rows. Louis Lefkowitz was the controller. They were all at the
Carlino
session.
Was Speaker of the Assembly.
He was Speaker of the Assembly. And I made it what I thought was a strong presentation, telling the governor, the state's got to do this and the state's got to do that. And I remember the governor's entire cabinet sitting with their arms folded. It wasn't a happy lot. Dennison and I are Democrats. He was a Democrat. He's passed away. And of course, the governor's entire entourage sort of viewed us as the enemy. And when I was all done, the governor jumped out of his seat, came forward. I thought he was going to assault me. And instead, he said, this is precisely what I wanted to hear. And I was very impressed. This governor was really a brilliant tactician. He took over the entire meeting. And he went on to comment, yes, we're going to do this on highways and we're going to do this on education. But most importantly, he followed it up. The following week, I got a call from the governor to sit down and discuss some of these issues. And for a young planner, that was quite an experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when it came to the medical center...
Rockefeller was a Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth.
Brilliant man.
Really?
Brilliant man.
Yeah. Dyslexic.
Yes. I didn't know that too many people knew that.
Yes. Right.
He didn't exactly advertise.
No.
Yes, he was Phi Beta Kappa, but I might point out that none of the Rockefellers were behind the door when brains were passed out.
Right.
David Rockefeller is a brilliant financier, and Lawrence Rockefeller has been one of the leaders in the environmental movement in the United States. A very unusual, outstanding family. But the governor was very supportive of this university campus here, and I think in part because of Lee Dennison. Whenever Rockefeller was in Suffolk County, he would make a point of calling, and on occasion we'd have lunch at Dennison's home. In fact, I think one of the reasons Dennison moved from his small home in Port to his more palatial setting in Belterre was that he wanted to have a more decent place to entertain Governor Rockefeller. But be that as it may, the politics of the medical center was focused around the competition, external by those other sources, and internal in opposition by the medical fraternity. At that time, Otis Pike had moved from a town attorney in Riverhead to a member of Congress.
Yes.
And when the medical center issue was finally joined in that the trustees announced, you know, a public hearing to be held at the state center right across from the Capitol building, I think it's on State Street if I recall, they didn't have the Rockefeller campus at that time, and it was in that building just north, on the north side of the street opposite the Capitol building where the governor had his office.
The tower?
It wasn't the educational tower down by the river. This was in downtown, I forget what they call the building, but they had an auditorium in there, and that's where they held the meeting.
It was, well, never mind.
Do you know the building I'm talking about?
I know where the education building was, the old education
building. The old education building.
Yes.
Yeah, it was in that building.
Yes, I see. All right, that's north of, on the north side of Washington Street.
Washington, yeah. It's on the north side of the street.
Right.
And they had announced that they were going to have a public hearing. And the subject was this commission report and the location of the medical center. That was the agenda item. And
remember the date of that?
I can
63?
Give you the exact date because I have a clipping home that I carry in a different wallet. It was the day that Viola Luisi and those other civil rights people were murdered in the South.
Is that right?
Do you remember that woman, Viola Luisi? She was a housewife who went down on voter registration or something, and she and two others were slain.
Is this Alabama?
I believe it was Alice. Either Alabama or Mississippi. I'll get the article, make a Xerox for you.
Good.
Because you mentioned Long Island Press, and there's a tangential digression that was of coincidental interest, at least to me. And I'll get back to that in a moment. Lee Dennison called me up at home on Saturday and said, be at my house Sunday morning for breakfast. I want to send you to Albany. And I didn't know what it was about. And I went to his house, and he had this notice, and he said, it's important, we have to have the medical center, and I want you to go to Albany and present Suffolk's case. When he called me on Saturday, he told me what it was, you know, what the breakfast meeting would be about, and he said, put your comments together as to why Stony Brook should be the location. And then Saturday night, I wrote out what I thought was a well-reasoned set of arguments as to why it should be at Stony Brook. And I thought it was pro forma because the commission had recommended that it be at Stony Brook.
And you got a copy of your remarks?
I may have. I doubt it, and I'll tell you why. I had presumed that it was my first experience in meeting with an exalted body such as the head of higher education for the state of New York, so I was very circumspect in my language, very respectful in the approach, and I thought somewhat logical in the arguments as to why...
Was this Allen?
Pardon me?
Was Allen then a commissioner of higher education?
Yes. Yeah. Boy, you're going back in my memory. Yeah, Allen was the name. Be that as it may, when I sat down with Dennison that Sunday morning, I gave my comments, and it was about three typewritten pages, and I went through the demography of how Suffolk had grown and the fact that there was no tertiary care and how this represented a benefit to the people of the county and what I thought were logical arguments. And Dennison looked at it, and he always used to work with a very soft, thick lead pencil on yellow scrap paper, and he had the yellow pads on his kitchen table, and he's making slashes through my typewritten thing, and by the time he got done with the second page, there wasn't much left, and I was sort of decimated because I was his planner, and I figured, you know, he'd like what I'd do. And he said, this is crap, this is crap, this is crap. And he said, I'm sending you to Albany because I don't want you to come back.